This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, November 30th, 2007. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Anitra Grisales. We take a look at where the U.S. presidential candidates stand on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Argentina's former military dictator faces prosecution on charges of kidnapping and murder as part of the U.S.-sponsored Plan Condor. And students in Pakistan continue to call for Musharraf's resignation. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. Colombian President Álvaro Uribe has proposed that France take over mediation in talks between his administration and the FARC guerrillas. The proposal comes less than 24 hours after the Colombian army captured three suspected FARC rebels, with evidence that proves that a number of the group's best-known hostages are in fact alive. Mike Caesar reports.
Colombian officials announced today that they had seized videos, photographs, and letters, which provide the first hard evidence that a number of people kidnapped by Marxist guerrillas, including three American contractors and a former presidential candidate, are alive. The three Americans were kidnapped when their plane crashed in the jungle during a drug hunting mission in 2003. The former presidential candidate, Ingrid Betancourt, was kidnapped in 2002 along with her vice presidential running mate. The guerrillas want to exchange some 50 prominent hostages for hundreds of imprisoned guerrillas. Relatives expressed relief to know that the hostages are still alive, but expressed concern about their health. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez had been attempting to mediate a prisoner exchange, but Colombian President Álvaro Uribe recently terminated his efforts in what has become a political crisis between the nations. For FSRN, this is Mike Caesar in Bogota, Colombia.
Venezuelans will head to the polls this Sunday to vote in what has become a highly contentious referendum on constitutional reforms. Mike Fox has more from Caracas.
If passed, the constitutional reform will lower the work week to 36 hours, lower voting age to 16, and create a Social Security fund for the self-employed. But it will also eliminate presidential term limits and pass more power to President Hugo Chavez to draw new federal territories and name national authorities for those areas. Fears about the reform sparked protests in the last month and a half, many of which turned violent. Hundreds of thousands marched peacefully in Caracas yesterday to wrap up the campaign against the reform. Chavez supporters are filling the streets today to close the pro-reform campaign. The political climate in Venezuela is tense, and recent polls vary widely, with both camps predicting victory on Sunday. Mike Fox, FSRN, Caracas.
Florida farm workers are upping the ante in their campaign to pressure Burger King to pay a penny more per pound for Florida tomatoes. Andrew Stelzer reports from Miami.
The day started with more than 500 people marching through the streets of Miami, carrying signs reading Exploitation King, mocking the Burger King logo. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers, a group of Mexican, Guatemalan, and Haitian farm workers based out of a small town in southwest Florida, has been calling on Burger King to pay them more for picking tomatoes and is marching to Burger King's corporate headquarters for a rally to demand justice in the fields. Similar campaigns against Taco Bell and McDonald's have garnered success. The two fast food giants agreed to give a pay raise and a guarantee of better working conditions to the farm workers. But Burger King has been resistant thus far, calling the coalition's penny per pound of tomatoes pay raise demand a public relations gimmick in a press release earlier this week. Also this month, the Florida Tomato Growers Exchange, a statewide cooperative, announced they will slap a $100,000 fine on any grower that passes on the pay raise promised by McDonald's and Taco Bell to the farm workers. In 2005, a nationwide boycott was called before Taco Bell's parent company agreed to the coalition's demand, and many at the march speculate that a Burger King boycott may be the next step for this campaign. For FSRN, from Miami, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
Israel's high court today decided to uphold plans to cut fuel supplies to Gaza, ruling that the cuts do not pose harm to the civilian population. Rami Almagari has more.
Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak proposed the measure to cut off fuel supplies to the coastal region in October in response to Palestinian homemade rocket attacks on nearby Israeli towns. The Palestinian Petroleum Authority says the daily fuel supplies to Gaza have since been reduced to 160,000 liters out of the usual 700,000. The High Court will decide in 2 weeks whether to allow the Israeli government to cut electricity supplies to the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, Israeli naval forces have attacked Hamas-controlled police posts on southern Gaza shores in the past 48 hours, killing 9 Palestinians, including 2 civilians. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Rami Almighari in Gaza.
The European Parliament has passed a measure to tighten gun laws following the massacre earlier this month at a Finnish school where a student shot 6 classmates, the school principal, and nurse before turning the gun on himself. Cinema Nippard has more from Berlin.
Under the new EU guidelines, only adults over the age of 18 will be able to purchase and keep guns, with the exception of firearms for hunting and supervised target shooting. The new guidelines will cover internet sales and imports from third countries and require all 27 EU member states to keep detailed computer databases identifying each firearm, as well as the names and addresses of both the supplier and the buyer. However, Finnish centre-right MEP Alexander Stubb says the new rules wouldn't have made a difference in the recent school shooting in Finland, as the killer was already 18. Stubb says the new laws will just make it easier to track the people who own firearms, but won't actually prevent people from acquiring them. The tighter gun control laws are due to take effect by January 2008, but first they must obtain the formal approval of all 27 EU member states. Cinema Nippard reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Berlin.
150 major global companies today called for a legally binding and comprehensive international deal ahead of next week's UN climate summit in Bali, Indonesia. From London, Naomi Fowler reports.
It's an unprecedented coming together of some of the world's largest corporations, including Nike, Sky, and Nokia. The so-called Bali Communique calls for a legally binding UN framework to tackle climate change. The business leaders say an international agreement on emissions laws will put them all in the same boat when it comes to investing in alternative energy sources. The signatory companies state the cost of action to cut carbon emissions is less than the price of inactivity, and that the shift to a low-carbon world will create significant business opportunities for them. It remains to be seen whether their support will strengthen the resolve of officials gathering in Bali. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
Tomorrow marks the 20th annual World AIDS Day, and the theme is leadership. The United Nations Program on HIV and AIDS says there are about 33 million people currently living with AIDS. Over 28 million are in sub-Saharan Africa. The organizers are stressing that while progress has been made in the fight against AIDS, governments need to step up their leadership and keep the momentum going. With just 3 years to go until 2010, the target that governments have set to achieve universal access to prevention, treatment, care, and support, leadership must be demonstrated through concrete and immediate action. Hein Marai is a South African journalist and writer based in Johannesburg who focuses on HIV and AIDS. He says there's a distinct lack of leadership when it comes to the fight against AIDS, both globally and in South Africa.
The stance of the South African president, whether one calls it one of dissidence or denialism, is well known. And whether or not this is reflected in official policy, and it's not, it has certainly affected the way in which that policy is implemented, the practice of public health around HIV and AIDS in South Africa, and it's done it in a negative way. I don't think there's any disputing that people have died by the thousands over the past decade in South Africa, who should not be dead, and whose deaths could have been avoided. There's an enormously negative legacy that needs to be overcome here.
People and leaders across the globe are observing World AIDS Day with a global vigil, meetings, walks, and concerts. Today in the U.S., President Bush met with evangelical leaders, highlighting his belief that faith-based organizations are the best vehicles for such work. Later in a speech at the Calvary United Methodist Church in Maryland, he urged Congress to approve an additional $30 billion for the fight against AIDS worldwide over the next 5 years, and announced he would visit Africa early next year to further highlight the need and his administration's efforts. Former military dictator Jorge Rafael Videla and 16 other military leaders in Argentina will be prosecuted on charges of conspiring to kidnap and kill political activists in a scheme known as Plan Condor, developed by Henry Kissinger and George Bush Sr., head of the CIA at the time. Dictators in Uruguay, Chile, Paraguay, Brazil, and Argentina killed opponents in the 1970s and 80s under the plan, which was also called Operation Condor. Marie Trigona reports from Argentina, where some 30,000 people were disappeared as a result, leaving loved ones to seek justice decades later.
My name is Emi Dambra, mother of two disappeared, a girl and a boy. The girl was disappeared here in Buenos Aires.
In front of the clandestine detention center where her daughter was tortured while pregnant and later murdered, Emmy Damber participated in a homage to victims of Plan Condor. Inside the Orletti Auto Garage, which also functioned as a clandestine detention center tucked in a residential neighborhood in Buenos Aires, hundreds perished. Not only Argentines, but also citizens from Uruguay, Cuba, Chile, and Bolivia. According to Damber, those responsible for leading the bloody military junta should be put behind bars and not like former dictator Jorge Rafael Videla under house arrest.
Orletti was the prototype example of Plan Condor. Here they held prisoners from Uruguay and other countries.
Former dictator Jorge Videla, now 82, is currently under house arrest, already found guilty for stealing babies born in captivity during the bloody junta. The former dictator may now face a jail cell for his participation in Operation Condor, a transnational state-sponsored terrorist coalition among the militaries of the Southern Cone of Latin America. In 1977, Videla, speaking to journalists, recognized the phenomenon of forced disappearances, but suggested they were disappeared because they were participating in armed clandestine struggle.
In our country, people have been disappeared. This is a sad reality. But objectively, we should recognize why and through whom they were disappeared. These people went disappeared because they went clandestine.
At least 25 Bolivian citizens were disappeared in Argentina during the 1976-83 military dictatorship. Ruth Shanos, a representative from the Bolivian Association of Family Members of the Detained and Disappeared, said regional dictatorships use Plan Condor to target dissidents with the support of former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger.
Centralmente, el Plan Condor fue un proceso.
Plan Condor was a joint plan developed through Henry Kissinger, a criminal who hasn't been punished yet. The plan established with the military dictatorships in Latin America was a process of forced disappearances of all social activists who in the 70s and 80s were looking for a social transformation in their respective countries.
Patrick Rice, an Irish priest who was disappeared by a commando group in a Buenos Aires shantytown in 1976, said the internationally coordinated disappearances of people continues today.
A phenomenon is happening more and more now in the context of what is called the global war on terrorism, where the practices of enforced disappearances with secret detention centers such as Guantanamo, with the return to the use of the hood. The hood for us is a symbol of disappearances. People detained in places on the slow's location, the practice of extraordinary renditions, all of this point, which is a new form of the Operación Condor.
Videla and other military leaders will face trial early next year. Human rights groups continue to push for nations to sign the UN-sanctioned Treaty Against Forced Disappearances, which the U.S. has refused to ratify. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigono, Buenos Aires.
On the 14th anniversary of the U.S. military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, the Human Rights Campaign and advocates for equal rights are calling for the repeal of the discriminatory policy. Catherine Jarmel reports.
Representatives of the Human Rights Campaign, log cabin Republicans, and retired service members stood in front of 12,000 flags at the National Mall today. The flags represent the number of members who have been removed from the military in the past 14 years because of sexual preference. Joe Solomnese is president of the Human Rights Campaign. He explains the urgency of repealing what he calls a failed policy.
Don't Ask, Don't Tell is a policy that is affecting our national security. And by not addressing a national security issue, it means that our leaders are failing us.
The policy was first implemented by President Clinton as a reversal from his original campaign promise to ensure equal rights for gay service members in the military. The current military policy states that allowing gay and lesbian members to serve, quote, would create an unacceptable risk to the high standards of morale, good order and discipline, and unit cohesion that are the essence of military capability, end quote. 28 military generals and admirals presented a letter to Congress calling for a repeal of the policy. Major General Dennis Lake signed the letter. He says many nations, such as Britain and Israel, allow gays to openly serve in the military.
Our service members are professionals who are able to work together effectively despite differences in race, gender, religion, and sexuality. Such collaboration reflects the strength and the best traditions of our democracy.
Former Petty Officer First Class Rhonda Davis came forward about her sexual orientation in June 2006. She describes what it meant for her to keep her relationship and lifestyle secret.
After 11 and a half years of having to worry every time I passed a closed door at work, worried that my commanding officer was in there talking to somebody and he had heard the information that I was gay, and I would pass the hallway and I would worry that today's the day I'm going to get kicked out.
She criticized the military for recruiting and accepting persons who had felony charges or who had low military test scores, but denying qualified gay persons from serving. House Bill 1246 calls for a policy of non-discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. The bill was introduced in February 2006 and has been in committee since March. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Catherine Jarmel.
President Musharraf has said that the state of emergency, which many consider de facto martial law, will be lifted on December 16th in the lead-up to January's elections. Students in Lahore, however, remain steadfast in their demands for Musharraf's immediate resignation, the reinstatement of ousted members of the judiciary, and a boycott of the elections by opposition parties. Student demonstrations, which started at individual campuses, have recently coalesced into a multi-campus student movement, culminating in an all-student rally today. Amber Vora reports from Lahore.
I'm a student from LSE, and I'm here to actually defy the PCO and the rule of military.
Students of Punjab University, they have also come here to show the solidarity with all their friends, with all their fellow students of different academic institutions and universities of Lahore.
These students are from two of more than a dozen universities that participated in today's rally. The youth mobilization has taken Pakistan by surprise after decades of depoliticized campuses, a legacy of previous military dictator Zia-ul-Haq, who banned student political organizations. Rasool Bakhsh Rais, a political science professor at the Lahore University of Management Sciences, also known as LUMS, explains their involvement.
And why these young students are engaged in this struggle or this social movement that is in the making is that they are patriotic and they want to see their country to have an identity which is very modern and which is civilized. Pakistan's image and Pakistan's international prestige has suffered, and that really creates problems of identity for young people, and therefore they want to change all that. And the best way to change is that that Pakistan must be brought back to the rails of constitutionalism and democracy.
Indeed, many students such as Aisha from LUMS have been angered by Musharraf's November 3rd statement that Pakistan is not ready for democracy.
His speech was an insult to the Pakistani public. It was insulting to think that we were not ready for democracy, and it was insulting to think that somebody else had to tell us when we were ready to accept our own civil rights.
At the rally, a law student from Punjab University summarized the demands of the All Student Action Committee.
The people are here together to fight against the dictatorship, to fight against the military rule, to fight against emergency. And we demand that the boycott of the election should be made by all the political parties. We also demand for that the judges who have not taken oath under PCO, they should be restored. We also demand that emergency should be uplifted by Musharraf.
Another common theme was anger among students about the United States' role in their country's politics.
The American influence is very much in Pakistan politics. And since birth, I've hearing about that we have to actually satisfy Washington first, then we can actually run our politics. Why? Why is that? Well, we are an independent nation. We can do anything.
Although a large contingent of police kept a watchful eye on the several hundred students, the protest remained peaceful, with students giving speeches and chanting slogans such as this one.
Saying this is an old freedom chant during the British. It means we'll take our freedom in any way possible. We'll take our freedom. Students want freedom. The lawyers want freedom. The workers want freedom. The peasants want freedom. That's it.
While no one is sure what direction the student movement will take in the months to come, many remain hopeful that these newly mobilized youth will play a transformational role in the future of Pakistani politics. For FSRN, this is Amber Vora in Lahore, Pakistan.
Bilal Hussein, an Iraqi photojournalist for the Associated Press, will appear before an Iraqi court next week, though the prosecution has yet to reveal what charges he will face. Hussein, who is part of a team of AP photojournalists that won a Pulitzer Prize in 2005, was seized from his Ramadi apartment by the U.S. military in April of last year. He has now been held for 19 months without charge. Aaron Siegel has more.
Just this week, U.S. Navy Captain Brian J. Bill notified AP lawyer Paul Gardaif that Bilal Hussein is to be tried in Iraqi criminal court on Sunday, December 9th. The military, however, has still not revealed what charges he will face. The Associated Press, from informal sources in the military, has said that the U.S. military believes Hussein was working with Iraqi insurgents, a charge that the AP firmly denies. At a Department of Defense news briefing, Pentagon Press Secretary Jeff Morrell fielded questions regarding Hussein.
After apprehending him and holding him, they now believe it is appropriate to refer his case to the Central Criminal Court of Iraq. And it's up for the Iraqis to decide what they wish to do with him from that point on.
Morrell says the U.S. military regards Hussein as a security threat.
They characterized him as a terrorist media operative who infiltrated the AP. They found IED devices or materials in his home, as well as some other discomforting evidence, and as a result of that, they've held him, and now they're recommending that he be tried.
The Associated Press rejects the accusation that IED devices were found in Hussein's home. Its own investigations find that the explosives were reported by soldiers who had seen these materials in the electrician shop that was located beneath Hussein's second-floor apartment. The Associated Press's president and chief executive officer, Tom Curley, defends Hussein's innocence. In a letter to Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, Curley has also expressed concerns over a fair trial. U.S. military attorneys have had 19 months to prepare a case, while Mr. Hussein's attorney will have no idea which allegations and what evidence he must seek to overcome with arguments and evidence of his own. Daryl Lang, the news editor for Photo District News, a magazine that covers various aspects of the photo world, has followed Hussein's story since September 2006.
Raises a very real possibility that an Iraqi photographer is being imprisoned because of his work, because of showing pictures that the U.S. military doesn't want seen. And that's a really serious threat to the freedom of information and freedom of reporting on this war. It's hard to say for certain that's what's happened because there's so many vague elements to this that aren't answered yet, but that would be an extremely serious problem if that's true.
Lang says many other photographers in Fallujah captured the same scenes as Hussein, so it's unclear why he's been singled out as a threat.
It's hard to imagine that after 19 months in prison, he suddenly revealed something they didn't already know. But I who knows? It could be anything. It could just be that they're tired of people asking questions about him, and they might as well just go on with something that would, you know, bring a definitive answer to his case. I don't know.
Jim McMillan is an award-winning photojournalist who is part of the Associated Press's 2005 Pulitzer Prize-winning team in Iraq.
Understanding that I spent a lot of time with American forces, I understand why there are good reasons to detain and identify legitimate journalists. And it's complicated because, you know, the camera has become a weapon of the insurgents. It's an information war as well as a literal war. And so I can understand why Americans would be suspicious of a guy with a camera at after an attack. And yet, Bilal and all of the journalists that I worked with were credentialed by the coalition, basically, and carried those credentials. So a brief detention wasn't alarming, and I don't know at what point I caught on that it was different.
According to the international organization, the Committee to Protect Journalists, over the last 3 years, dozens of journalists, mostly Iraqi, have been held by U.S. troops. While most are released after a short period, CPJ reports, in at least 8 cases, journalists have been held for weeks or months without charge. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Aaron Siegel in San Francisco, California.
In lieu of FSRN's weekly political roundup, we take a look at the presidential candidate's stance on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, an issue that has been in the news this week but hasn't been a top priority on the campaign trail. Now that peace negotiations between Israel and Fatah-controlled Palestine are underway, the next president will likely have to engage in the process. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell takes a look at where the candidates stand on this decades-long conflict.
As foreign policy goes, Israel and Palestine have barely been mentioned by the presidential candidates. Iran and Iraq have dominated the discussion. As Dr. Jess Ganim, a professor at the University of California, San Francisco, and Palestinian advocate, says, few differences exist between the candidates on the Palestinian-Israeli issue.
If you listen to the major candidates, you can really see that there are no differences in their approach to thinking about how to approach this really critical issue at this important historical moment.
The main candidates on the Republican side, Mike Huckabee, Rudy Giuliani, Mitt Romney, and John McCain, and on the Democratic side, John Edwards, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, and Chris Dodd, have voiced unconditional support for Israel, calling on Palestinians to recognize Israel and renounce terrorism.
First of all, the Palestinians have to say and acknowledge and mean it that Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish state.
We really can't in any way accommodate any effort which would reduce Israel's security and the 1,000-plus rockets that have been launched from the Gaza Strip.
The major candidates often fail to talk about important issues to the Palestinians, such as water, borders, and Palestinian refugees. But not all candidates have always had such a one-sided position. Barack Obama has said in the past, before he became a senator, that the Palestinian people need rights too. And Hillary Clinton spoke out on behalf of the Palestinian plight for rights in the 90s. During a trip to Gaza as First Lady with her husband, she met with Suha Arafat, the wife of then-Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. But scorned by many in the American public, she has worked to correct that image. Clinton sponsored legislation in 2007 that calls for the immediate release of all Israeli prisoners held in Palestinian jails, legislation endorsed by many pro-Israeli groups. In a pro-Israel ranking called the Israel Factor by Haaretz newspaper, Clinton is ranked second most supporting among all candidates. Rudy Giuliani is ranked first. Giuliani has traditionally exhibited a pro-Israeli stance. In 1995, as mayor of New York, he had Yasser Arafat ejected from a concert in New York City. Ron Robbins is academic dean of NYU's Steinhardt School. He also is a judge for the Israel Factor.
Literally, none of the candidates have said anything that one would, you know, would raise an eyebrow or would raise concerns or, in fact, raise any expectations, happy expectations. Basically, regurgitation of cliches that we've heard on and on and on. United States supports Israel.
A few candidates do offer different positions on the conflict, the candidates that aren't considered top tier. In an interview with FSRN in August, Republican candidate Ron Paul said the U.S. must stop providing more than $2 billion in military aid to Israel.
There'd be a stronger motivation for the Israelis to get along with their neighbors, have peace treaties, maybe with Syria that we impede. So there's a strong argument for neutrality over there and just not supporting either side, but being friends with both sides and trade with both sides and yet not get involved in these regional and internal affairs.
Democrat Dennis Kucinich has been critical of the Israeli government's disparate economic treatment of Palestinians. And Democrat Mike Gravel said after Iraq, Israel and Palestine would be his most important foreign policy initiative. Avi Becker is visiting scholar at Georgetown University. He talks about the candidates who are mum on the issue.
What you call really the silence, you know, because there is no willing on anybody there really to engage in really controversial debate.
Democrat Joe Biden was the only candidate to put out a statement following the Annapolis summit. He applauded the beginning of peace talks. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFA in Berkeley, I'm Anitra Grisales.